Hello, fellow Rebel Capitals. Hope you're well. I'm here with my good buddy, Chris McIntosh, and I've been thinking a lot about Plan B, being here in Argentina with the CBDC Road Trip to Freedom Challenge, and also commodities. So I thought, boy, there's no better person to talk to than Chris McIntosh himself. So, buddy, welcome back to the Rebel Capitals Show. Thanks for coming on.
Good to be back, man. Good to be back, and I'm keen to catch up on your eventful trip.
Yeah, so first, well, let's dive into it, because I want to get your thoughts, and maybe we can just kind of think this through out loud in front of the audience. Initially, I was not worried about getting cash. Like, the whole premise was, let's try to transact with Bitcoin, gold, and silver, and if that doesn't work, or if there's something that I can't buy with one of those three, then we'll go ahead and sell whatever we could to get the cash required to go ahead and make the purchase. But like, I thought we'd be able to buy a lot of stuff with Bitcoin. I mean, just looking at like that BTC map, the .org or the app, It shows you all of these destinations, all these businesses, as an example in Mendoza, that accept Bitcoin. And I didn't see any hotels. So I thought, well, for gas and hotels, we'll probably have to sell some Bitcoin or sell some gold or silver. But we'll be able to eat and get a lot of food and maybe some of the other things that we need at local stores just by doing the transaction directly. And then I thought the biggest problem would be finding people that would, as far as the precious metals, I thought the biggest problem would be finding gold dealers or silver dealers. So I was way off. What ended up happening was, not only did nobody accept Bitcoin, that the app is worthless. Like, we literally went to 10 places on the app just in Mendoza when we first got here that said they took Bitcoin, and none of them did. Not even one. And a couple of them even had stickers on the window, like the Bitcoin sticker.
Oh, yeah.
And then we went and tried to, and there was tons of gold dealers, like tons of gold and silver dealers. They were like, they usually congregate in one part of town, is what I noticed.
Yeah.
And in Mendoza, it's a town of like 1.1 million. There was probably, in this little strip mall area, like 50 gold dealers. The problem is, none of them wanted gold, or so they wanted jewelry.
Yeah,
they wanted jewelry. And we had like those gold coins, like those 10th of an ounce gold coins,
right?
And then the silver ounces.
Yeah.
And like 50% of them wouldn't even buy them at any price. They're like, we don't want them. And then the other 50% only wanted them just for their coin value, not necessarily because they were made out of silver. So we found a few people that would give us a reasonable price for the silver ounces, or the Canadian maple leaves, or whatever they're called. But the best price I could get for the 10th of an ounce gold coin was $100. And wow, spot is probably like 230. And then they'd only buy one. They wouldn't even buy two of them. So the problem became not finding gold or silver dealers, but the problem became finding people that actually wanted the gold, and then or the silver, and then being able to sell enough of it to get you to the next destination. And then on the Bitcoin side, the problem was not just finding people that would transact. That was nobody. But then actually finding people that actually would buy the Bitcoin from us. And that was also nobody. So if we would have done this whole trip with Bitcoin, I mean, Josh and I would still be...
You'd be hungry.
We'd be homeless. We'd be living in a shelter somewhere in the gutter of Argentina. I don't know what would happen. We probably would have had to just do like Western or something like that to have Adriana send us some cash. But the main conclusion there is, we have this false sense of security, I think. Meaning people that value freedom, liberty, and free market capitalism and our privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And that if we have a dollar crash or hyperinflation, or if we have a CBDC, well, that's no problem, because I'm just stacking silver Or, oh, that's no problem because I'm just stacking my gold coin. Or, oh, that's no problem because I'm just accumulating Bitcoin. And what you realize in a hurry is you can stack or accumulate all that stuff that you want, but unless you find someone else that actually wants it, you can't turn it into purchasing power. You can't turn it into food or shelter or any of the things you would need. And I think the pushback there, if we were in the United States, Chris, or New Zealand or Australia or something, is, oh, well, of course, people haven't gravitated to it yet, because although 9% inflation in the United States might be high, it's not that extreme. But boy, oh boy, Chris, wait till we start getting some hyperinflation. Then you're going to see Gresham fall, and everybody's going to try to get rid of these dollars or whatever the local currency is, and they're going to just be fighting over any scrap of gold or silver or piece of Bitcoin or sat that they can get. And it's not that way. I'm living it right here in hyperinflation of Argentina.
It's simply not. People need to read history. They really need to read history. And I would suggest even reading, like biographies of people who are not necessarily talking about the monetary side of things, but just what living life is like in various periods of history. And the thing that you find with that, despite high inflation and everything else, at a high level, yes, people will rapidly move capital in order to take advantage of a hyperinflation. In other words, they'll buy land, they'll buy... Rich people, exactly. But your middle class, who get decimated always, and your lower class, they use cash. They will continue to use cash. You know, I know that you were in Turkey, last year? Can't remember when it was last year. And I remember you and I had a conversation about this. And people were, they would take dollars and they would take euros, but they would still take lira. Mm. And they will transact their lira typically when I was talking to taxi drivers and wait staff and hotel staff and things of that nature, typically on a weekly basis. They would say, okay, I've got, whatever I've kind of pooled and collected over the last week. If you're in that cash economy, right, as a taxi driver, you're receiving money every day. Obviously, if you're on a salary, it's a different situation. But those guys, they would wait about a week, because the inflation that was experienced within a week was manageable. It's like, okay, and then they might go and they start transacting. So what they're doing is very similar to your wealthy people. Just the wealthy people are transacting with higher value items, right? So they're buying land and they're buying...
A longer time horizon.
They've got a longer time horizon, and then they've got much more capital to be utilizing. But at a transactional level, in other words, what you guys just did, at that level, it's cash. It's been cash throughout these inflationary periods. And that's, I think, one of the biggest risks here, is that people are super complacent around that. And if they replace that cash with digital, you are very much seconded into this environment whereby they can control what you spend your money on and when and where, right? Because it can be controlled geophysically and, of course, in terms of what you actually spend it on, certain items, if everything is digitized. So now... Certain parts of the world, I think that's more easily implemented in terms of the digitization. So if you think about a Walmart in, say, Florida or something like that, categorizing all the items on the shelves, right? And then having a database which can track that with your app, with your CBDC, is quite easy, right? Oh, right. You bought a steak. Oh, you bought a can of beans. Oh, you bought some hairspray, whatever. It's easier. As you guys have just experienced traveling through, and you live in Medellin, that doesn't necessarily work. It can work in the big box retailers, but there's a ton of different businesses that are not in that space, and they don't have the capital or the capabilities or the technology or anything of that nature to digitize the assets. In other words, the can of beans on the shelf, the asado that you go to, right? In that space, it doesn't really matter if they have a central bank digital currency because to some extent, geophysically, fine. They might say, oh, you're in Mendoza. You can't leave Mendoza, your central bank digital currency gets cut off if you're in a different state or whatever. Sure, that can still exist. But at that local level, I suspect we would have an explosion in basically a black market. In other words, if they're saying, oh, you can't buy 14 cans of beans, you can only buy 13 cans of beans, or you've had too much of your steak today, George, or whatever, right? We've talked about these things in the past. Because that's not digitized and they can't physically control it, that would become an enormous black market immediately, because the demand would still exist for the steak or the 14th can of beans or whatever it is. And because it can't be controlled, because it's not digitized, that would just, it wouldn't function, and you would have this black market operating. And I've seen some of that taking place in third world African countries where I grew up in, especially when you had capital controls in place and they tried to control capital with certain, like, for example, in Zimbabwe, you couldn't own a vehicle that was younger than 10 years old, things like that. But how do you control that? When someone buys a vehicle, fine, it gets registered in terms of its age. But of course, people will adjust these things. And so there's a black, because it can't, because none of those, the databases were digitized sufficiently and held in some central bureaucracy, that was efficient enough. In other words, like when you have a car that gets registered and it's a, I don't know, 2020 model car, okay, and gets registered on some government database, you buy the car, it has various, they have VIN numbers here, in the US they'll have different numbers. In a country like Zimbabwe, which is completely inefficient in that, the ability to basically go and manipulate and change any of those details on what was literally a piece of paper or print a new one off of a printer was very, very easy. So people did it all the time. So you'd have these vehicles driving around, which are brand new, but you looked at the registration and they were, guess what, 11 years old. In a similar light, that was just the market mechanism reacting to an insane policy. So I think that, sorry.
Yeah, that, here's the problem. And I never would have thought of this before, but it's getting the money here. If you want to transact outside of the system, it's almost impossible. So right now, as an example, Chris, nobody can get more than $40 from an ATM machine. So what ends up happening is you have to get there at like 8 o'clock in the morning, wait in line for an hour, and then the first 100 people get cash, and then the rest of the people are just SOL. And so you see these huge lines in the morning, and then by 10 or 11, there's no line at all, because all the ATMs are quite literally out of money. They're just, because right now the value of the currency has decreased so much that their highest, or their, well, they just came out with a 2000 peso note, but 99% of the notes, the highest notes are 1000, which is about a dollar. Yeah. So imagine you're having to transact in just dollar bills. Right. So you go to the ATM, it's clean out in every single bank in every single town by 10 or 11. Okay. So let's just assume for a moment you're an American and you want to think about a plan B. They implemented the CBDC. You want nothing to do with it. So you're like, okay, I want to live the next 2 years in Argentina or Colombia or Turkey or something like that, because I've got this plan B set up. Okay, fine. How do you get that 250,000? To Turkey, right? So, okay, before I thought, well, what you could do is you could have like $10,000 in cash. And by the way, you want $100 bills because you get a much lower exchange rate for 20s or 50s. They just want $100 bills. And then I'm like, okay, well, you could have some, you know, a couple gold watches. You could have a few ounces of gold. You could have a few ounces of silver to transact when you first get there. And then you could have some Bitcoin. Okay. Well, now that Bitcoin might as well be pixie dust. Nobody wants it. And it's not that I had a lot of people push back on Twitter, say, well, of course, it's Gresham's Law. They don't want to transact in the sound money. I'm like, no. It's not that they don't want to transact in the sound money. They flat out don't want it. Like they don't. And so why is that? I think we should go into the psychology, and then we'll circle back to this problem that I'm talking about. The psychology is actually pretty simple. It's they don't have savings. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to consume less than they produce, but they're trying to build up what we would consider like a 6-month buffer, right? Well, I forgot what Dave Ramsey calls that. You call that the emergency, right? So let's just say that right now, your emergency fund would be $5,000. So if you're like Josh, or you're a young person, or you're 30, something like that, you're trying to make ends meet, you get a decent job, the first thing that you want to do is set aside $5,000 in case of an emergency, or $10,000, or whatever it is. And then once you get that $10,000 in the bank, then you can go ahead and think about maybe buying a house, or buying some gold, or Bitcoin, or stocks, or something like that. But until you get that $10,000, you're not even thinking about speculating, for heaven's sakes, because you want to make sure that if your car gets wrecked, or if your kid has to go to the hospital or something like that, you've got plenty of money to cover that. So if you were setting up that emergency fund, would you want that as an American? Anyone on this live stream right now, would you want that emergency fund that you might have to dip into in the next 3 months to pay for something catastrophic? Would you want that denominated in Bitcoin? Of course not. Why? Because the volatility is too extreme. You don't know. It could be worth $100,000 in 3 months. It could be worth $30,000. And you're buying it at $65,000. And it's not to say that you don't think it's going to go up over the long term. But the bottom line, it's too volatile. And I had this conversation with Breedlove the other day when we were talking about Sailor, like the quintessential Bitcoin bull, or Maxi, right? And he's running his business. And I asked Breedlove, I said, well, Robert, what do you think he keeps his working capital in? You think he keeps his working capital in Bitcoin? Of course not. Of course, because you're taking this FX risk, right? Where he needs that money on a short-term basis. So they just want something that's as stable as they can possibly get. And that's the US dollar, whether we like it or not. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is, the few places that we did find, Chris, that would accept crypto, what did they want? They didn't want Bitcoin. They wanted Tether.
Or USDT. I've seen the same thing.
That's Tether. They wanted the USDC, which is basically Coinbase. They wanted a stable coin. That's what they wanted. And the few people that did take Bitcoin, as soon as we gave them the Bitcoin, they immediately transferred it on Binance over to USDT. Why? Because they're at the point in their life or the economy where society is moving forward. You know, the standard of living is increasing. I would argue to a certain extent, even here, which sounds weird, but I could explain that later. But they're at the stage of the game here where they're building up that emergency fund or that working capital from your business, if you want to leave it that way. And they cannot afford to take any FX risk. They just want whatever is stable as possible, even if there isn't a high probability that it moons in the next 6 months because the halving or whatever. Yeah, they don't give a shit about the halving. No. And so
still in a survival mode.
That's right. So circling back, and if any place is going to be super excited to take a hard money, it should be a country that's in hyperinflation. And again, to your point, that's not reality. That's theoretical. But in practice, it's a complete opposite. So going back to this problem, if you want to set up the plan B, if you had $250,000 right now in the United States and you wanted to get that to Argentina outside of the system to live on in the next 2 years, how do you do it? And right now, I'm drawing a blank. I don't, because even if you had the Bitcoin, gold, silver, okay, great. So how do you find someone that will take the Bitcoin? And even if you do, you think they're going to want, or they're going to be able to give you cash for $250,000? Of course not. Even if it's like $1,000 a week or something like that for you to live, it's not realistic. And then what are you going to do? You can't carry enough silver coins. I mean, think about how many coins you'd have for $250,000. You're going to take that on a plane? Absolutely not. You're going to take a watch? Okay, where are you going to get the liquidity for that if you can't even find someone that will buy a gold coin? And as you go through these scenarios, the conclusion that you come to, and maybe you take Tether, But even if you take Tether, then how do you turn that into purchasing power? And if the people here can't even get $40 a day in cash, how the hell are you going to find someone that just that isn't a bank? And the banks don't even have that much money to give you $4,000 in cash every single month. It's not possible. And then you say, well, shit, I'd have to have an Argentinian bank account and I'd have to wire the money. And now you're right back into
the financial Klaus's system
wheelhouse.
Yeah. Give me one tick. I just got to lay down a whining dog.
Sure. So when Chris gets back, I really want it. And I haven't discussed this with him
prior. Sorry, okay. Back.
Yeah. So I know you've probably thought these things through, but now that you have this boots on the ground intel, do you have any suggestions? Because I don't want to wave. I'm not waving the white flag. I don't want people to think that.
Right now, I'm
at a dead end based on this experience.
So, I mean, there's a couple of things that come to mind. And go back to what you began with at the start, which is largely, I think, a misunderstanding by most of us with respect to what a hyperinflation actually looks like and what that means for the average person. I think there's a misunderstanding largely as a consequence of the material that gets put out, and we might even be guilty of this, right? Gets put out by people in a certain position, right?
Right.
To some extent, it's you know, ivory tower academics, you know? You go, oh, well, you know, what do I do with my few $100,000 or a few $1 million or whatever it is? Like, but that's not a reality it's not a reality for society. And what matters is society, because you and I could be multimillionaires or billionaires or whatever. But if we're living in an environment that is not filled with people like that, then we're the complete anomaly. And the way that we live is vastly different to the way that other people live. And most importantly, the way that other people live dramatically affects our lives, because that is society. In other words, how do you live in a society that looks like X? So what that society looks like in a hyperinflation is very important. And this comes back to some of the topics that we discussed in Dubai.
Right.
If you, my belief is that the most robust of community societies are ones which are already held together to some degree at a community level. And that could be familial, it could be religious, it could be community, it could be whatever. Okay. Largely, that's going to put you outside of the cities anyway, regardless. You know, Alex Craner talked a bit about this in Dubai, right, where you had these like smallest communities in Croatia. And even during a war and during inflation and everything else, basically, if you needed to get something done, whether it was the local mechanic or whether it was some beef down the road from the farmer or whatever it was, people found ways to actually do that. Now, it does mean that actual production and transactions dramatically fall. Why? Because your friction goes up massively. And that's what cash does. Cash allows for a less frictioned environment. Despite all the stuff that everyone gets pissed off about the US dollar and everything else, the fact is the US dollar is the liquidity or the grease in the world at a foundational level for average people. Forget about the billionaires and everything else. Sure, they're going to transact in other asset classes simply because they can, because they've already solved that problem of you know, transactability at a everyday level.
The billionaires, Chris, couldn't get food. They couldn't. Yeah. They could remain rich on paper, but they couldn't put a roof over their head.
So I think this comes into the next thing, which is in any individual area, if you're going to be making some investments, and I know you know this to some degree because you're living in Colombia and you have investments in Colombia, and guess what those investments do for you? They give you an income, right? So if you are going to move assets into any plan B type country, it's not sufficient to just have a house there or a pad or something. And they go, cool, that's that done. And then think that you're just going to arrive with a bag of cash and live the next 2 years in a relatively stable environment. That's unlikely to take place. A, because you can't move the cash as you found. And B, then you're going to get there and you're going to have this beautiful home, but you can't even pay the water bill. So
right.
So the ability to have cash flows in wherever your plan B actually happens to be, I think is one massively missed point that people aren't paying any attention to.
I'm actually writing this down because that is a fantastic point.
It's better, in other words, for example, it would be better to, here's two scenarios. Let's say you want your plan B in Mendoza. You could go down the road and you could buy some house, maybe a flat, maybe a big house, maybe a farm, whatever it is. You could do that with that capital. Let's just say it's $500,000. Or you could take $500,000 and you could put it into a few rental properties. Mm-hmm. When you arrive, you can go and you can stay in the hotel down the road because you've got an income stream that allows you flexibility to do that. The income stream tied to an asset, which can also hold value in hyperinflation, is far more important. The one is stock and the one is flow. Stock value, home, doesn't necessarily fall in value in a hyperinflation. Flow is just the cash coming out of it. The same would be like a farm. Farm is worthless if it doesn't produce you actual, if it doesn't have any production. In fact, now it's a burden because it takes a lot of money to actually maintain it. And you're actually, when you're buying a farm, it's a business. It has to operate. Not all farms are profitable. So you kind of fall into a much more nuanced type of investment. But from an easy perspective, you can buy a bloody rental property like you do in Colombia, rent it out, and it's fairly manageable, you know, and you've got an income stream. So,
yeah.
That's a better way. And then what you're doing is you're transacting at that top level where you're bringing in a fair amount of capital, and you're still going to have to go through the financial system to do it in some instances.
But if you could do that in advance, Chris, like as an example, if I could wire $250,000 down here or buy a property like an Airbnb, and then I can do that now, that's not impacting my social score yet. And so you get that set up, and then I come down here and hopefully I could rent that out for cash. You're still transacting outside of the system, and you got a couple grand coming in every single month that can subsidize the rest of the money you're able to get by selling your Bitcoin or gold or silver or whatever it was that you were able to bring with you.
Yeah, there's an interesting little scenario. If you look at what's been happening in Russia, so Russia obviously got cut out of the SWIFT system. They've been sanctioned. It's very difficult for Russians to get their capital into other jurisdictions. Incidentally, it's also, if you're in a Western banking system, it's difficult to get your money into Russia just because they don't want to deal with Russian banks. Not because the Russians are saying don't bring money in. That's not the problem. The problem is just that the banks don't want to be seen to be dealing at all with any Russian banks. Right. And so I was doing a transaction last year, I think it was. And so to get money into Russia, basically it's USDT. And so what that's, again, it's dollars basically. And it gives them stability.
So let me think about it. So you, let's say we take $250,000, we send it USDT to someone on that has like a Binance account.
Yeah.
And they take that and then they pay a spread, but they take that USDT, sell it for rubles, and then that's how we buy the property.
Yeah.
In this scenario, right? Yep. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And that's what's happening a lot in Russia and places like that. And again, it's not something that you're gonna do. You're not gonna buy your latte with it. It's just far too much friction, far too much volatility in the pricing. And they're also so we're talking about real estate in this instance, or larger pools of capital, right? But they're doing that transaction, because I watched it and I was asking questions. They're doing that transaction and they're switching it like immediately. They want no FX risk.
Right. Yeah.
So all that you're looking at is a utility value. It's basically a utility coin that's allowing them to transact between the systems. And so I think that is likely, like if we have this clampdown and CBDCs and everything else, I have a suspicion that technology and that utility value behind those will explode. I think that there will be a lot of dedicated resources that are put to it simply because the problem now is so extreme that's where a lot of innovation will take place and a lot of basically black market stuff will come out. And then the ability of the central bankers to actually control that will be another challenge. And you know, technology is both a liberator and it can also be a fantastic prison warden. And so that's the challenge that you're always moving through. And you know, certainly the internet has been a liberator to some degrees in our lifetimes. But with censorship and things like that, it becomes the opposite. So we're just in another phase of this. But I think that that's probable going forward. The question that we have at a macro level is where this gets implemented. And we know they're going to implement it. They've told us that it's coming. A central bank digital currency, in their hope, is a one currency or coalescing as many forces together to have one dominant currency. I think that's the challenge. That's the challenge, and they want to get that. And to some degree, it's important for them to get a sufficient tipping point. In other words, basically, what the dollar is today, if they could convert that into a central bank digital currency and everybody abides by that, we're done. That's a incredibly powerful tool. I suspect that's maybe not going to plan to the extent that they would wish it's going to plan for a whole host of reasons. But in that, there will come a certain level of, I would say, asymmetry in terms of that which presents you an opportunity outside of that system becomes so much more valuable. In other words, if you think of, go back to, like, say, Zimbabwe. When Zimbabwe went through their hyperinflation, well, they've been through a bunch of them. So I was there in, what was it, 2008, when they really went through the first major currency devaluations, and then they had significant capital controls. You couldn't cross the border with, like I was saying, motor cars that were older than 10 years. You weren't allowed, I think it was 10,000 rand, which at the time would have been maybe about 2.5 grand. Those sorts of controls were put in place. And then I watched what people did, both at a domestic level and then at a sort of higher level where they were moving goods. And basically people moved goods through the ports. You'd put barrels of oil on a bloody barge. You'd sign the papers and pay some guy some money. And the next thing you would have $10 million landing in a port in Athens, and you convert it into a bank account and you were done. That sort of transaction took place. But what it does is it just sucks the capital out of one jurisdiction. It sucks all the productivity out and it disperses it elsewhere. And that's why the place collapses. And so it accelerates the very collapse that they're trying to hold in and trying to stop. But there is asymmetry in that. Like, because the barrel of oil that you buy, to a large extent, you don't give a shit about the price. Let's say crude's trading at $80. Will you pay 85? 90, 95, 100? And the answer is typically yes, because your alternative is that you have the capital stuck in a situation where if it's in cash, it's hyperinflating. No. If it's in other assets, it's still falling. Value of things like real estate in local currency was going up, but in international currency is falling. So you have all these dynamics in play. And so your price that you will pay for that barrel of oil, and I'm simply using barrel of oil because people can kind of physically think about it, understand what it looks like and the value behind it. But you will pay a premium for that because of the utility value to move it. Now, you can go and say Bitcoin. Obviously, the Bitcoin utility value, we could argue, is higher because you don't have to ship it. You don't have to, like, go through the logistics. It doesn't have to sit at sea for 3 weeks or whatever it is. It's not 3 weeks, it's less, but... Do you know what I mean? And then you don't have to have all the contacts in wherever it is that you're sending it to, and people that you got to trust, and bank accounts set up, and it's a whole logistical fucking nightmare.
Look, I can tell you that transacting or even finding someone to buy Bitcoin is a logistical nightmare. I mean, it is. I thought it was going to be easy. It's impossible. You know, now if you're an MBA, you got a town of 15 million people, you're good to go. Like, you're going to probably be able to find someone there, especially if you're in a country of hyperinflation. But if you're in some of these towns of 1 million, 2 million, it ain't happening. I mean, you would be better off with a barrel of oil and just standing on the street and say, who wants it? I mean, and then not only that, even if you do have the app or whatever it is, then you've got to have an app that talks to the person that wants to buy it, right?
Yeah.
And then half the time those apps don't work. They completely fail. Mm. And then most of the apps that they're using down here as Americans, we can't even use, or Canadians, we can't even use. So you have, my point is, you have the exact same logistical challenges with Bitcoin. But going back to your earlier point, you know, getting the $10 million into XYZ country, you still have to have a bank account.
Mm.
And so you're still having to be a part of that system. And if you have multiple countries that are a part of a unified ledger, and one of those countries is your plan B country, then you got to scratch that one off the list, unless you can figure out a way to just live on the cash flow, literally cash flow, from that rental property or something like that. And, you know, a great point about the demand for oil being a lot higher just because of the utility value. It's just like me selling one of my gold coins that was worth $250, selling it for $150 just because I was broke and I needed to pay the hotel. And I didn't have a choice.
So I think this, I don't know what the solution is, but I think a solution, or at least the way that I'm viewing it, is that ahead of time, you need to have the railroad set up. And when I talk about the railroad, it's basically, for example, banking in these in multiple jurisdictions. We don't know which jurisdiction is going to go in which direction. On probability, we can see the likelihood of these things. And we can certainly see where there is bifurcation in the world, who's on, you know, who has what biases in which direction. Okay. As a consequence, you can view that world from a macro perspective and say, okay, I want to have chips on the table. And it doesn't have to cost a lot of money to set up bank accounts in multiple jurisdictions and put a little bit of money in them, because there it's there, it's sitting there. Your ability to then move quickly in and out of those still exists. Will that always exist? Probably not. But it's a decent setup now. And it allows for one to have that capability when you need it to put that in place. You can imagine if you had already had bank accounts set up in Argentina or maybe in Chile across the border or something like that, or even corporate entities. And I know people might think, oh, I can't do that. Yeah, it's not that bloody hard if you just pay attention and do some research. If you've got those things set up, your ability to then move in and out of the country is typically easier. And then, of course, the second step beyond that is the cash flows. If you're going to be buying any assets, you want to typically try and get cash flows in those jurisdictions with whatever currency they're using in that particular place. So that's the stock and flow side of things. And then you watch how the world.
But if you got that $250 in a Wells Fargo account, then you still got to wire it down to the Argentinian account. And that still has to go through the system. So if Klaus is cock blocking you, for lack of a better term, then you can't take that purchasing power with you. That's what I'm trying to figure out, is how the hell do you take that purchasing power with you? So even if they don't like you, you can still give them the finger and say, look, you know, as long as my passport's still valid, I can at least take this amount of purchasing power with me, so I can survive the next 2 years and figure it out.
Yeah, see, this is where it's not going to work. Ultimately, if they bring this in, it's going to create massive conflict. So let's go back and think about what's happened in Russia. Russia, they kind of did the same thing. They blocked them off. They said, you're not working in our financial system. Now, that's not distinctly different to the implementation of a central bank digital currency, which, if any participating countries become non-participating at any level, they basically then experience the same thing Russia has experienced. You're blocked from the system. You can't work with us. Okay. You're not using us. You're not friendly. Excuse me. We're going to sanction you financially to some degree. That's what it looks like. If you think through what a central bank digital currency is and the implementation of it, that is what will happen. You're either with us or you're against us, kind of scenario. Okay. So go back and let's have a see what happened in Russia. Russia managed to get through this. Why? Because it was a country which already had significant reserves domestically. So they had liquidity. It wasn't like they were rushing around going, shit, we need dollars, we need this, we need... No, they had liquidity. They were taught the lesson back in 2016, by the way. I could run through what happened there. But the point is they learned the lesson, they had sufficient liquidity, and then on a domestic basis, they have a fairly robust economy. That is, it's not, you know, people say, oh, it's a, you know, gas tank. What, a gas tank in a wheat field with a gun turret or something. But with nukes,
you're right.
With nukes, yeah. And it's much, much more than that. It's very much a Western propaganda narrative. Now, and so what they've managed to domestically continue operations. In fact, it's the fastest growing country GDP-wise within Europe now. And also they've continued to manage to transact at an international level with affiliated parties. I think that's largely what the world's going to continue to look like. So the question that for most people now is, where do I place some capital? My thinking is that you want to have at least some of that capital outside of whatever system you're in. And it doesn't matter what system you're in. Even if you're a Russian living in Russia, I would suggest you would want to have some, at least the railroads, you know, the sort of rail tracks in place in some other jurisdictions. But I think that that bifurcation is going to be coming. And so for right now, you want to be set up. You want to try and set up the bank accounts. You want to try and set up, if it's corporate entities, if you've got the capital, deploy some of it into other assets, preferably ones which have got cash flow, as I mentioned. And then if and when they deploy this, it's going to be a shut off. There'll be like, you will simply not, you're going to experience what you've just experienced, I think, but at an elevated level. The flip side of that is when that gets implemented to that degree, where that is not being implemented will represent relative freedom to a much, much greater extent. And the asymmetry behind that could be quite extraordinary. You can imagine if you've just done the trip that you've just done now, and then you went to Eastern Europe, say, just as an example, and you didn't have restrictions, or you didn't have the same level of restrictions in order to bring capital in order to move it around, and you didn't have some digital currency, on a relative basis, capital will go there. Human capital, physical capital. And you might say, oh, they're bringing in all these restrictions. The point I'm making is that it will move, just like I watched it move in Zimbabwe, where people literally put barrels of oil on barges. There was a guy I met who went and he got stuff from Caterpillar, machinery, put on a barge and sent it to Cape Town. I mean, like, it just capital shifts. It's going to happen, which ironically accelerates the decline in the very entity or jurisdiction that is attempting to implement those controls. Central bank digital currencies are controls at a level that is extreme, but it's no different to what these despotic third world shithole African dictatorships have done in the past. It's not any different. It's the same story. It's just at a greater level, which I would suggest actually presents you with greater opportunity too.
Because yeah, I'm just trying to think through how the average person deals with that. You know, the average person isn't going to be able to go out and buy a bulldozer
and
have it shipped to Argentina. And then if you do set up a bank account in Argentina, then you're going to have to hold your money in pesos, and it's not going to be worth anything by the time you get there. So it's, and again, I don't want to keep throwing problems at you, but I'm just trying to think this through out loud.
Yeah,
go through maybe different levels. Like if your net worth is this, this might be a good option. If your net worth is this, and kind of have three different levels, so people can start planning in advance. I mean, the one thing, and this goes back to you talking about community, and one of the main takeaways when we were in Dubai is, if I had, let's say, 3 or 4 months here in Argentina, I would be able to find the guys or gals that would accept those gold coins at a reasonable rate. Or I would be able to find the people that would probably accept Bitcoin, or at the very least Tether, and figure out how to to transact there without all that friction. But then the question becomes, do they even have enough cash? Even if you have that network, do they have enough cash for you to buy with whatever it is they want that you're holding outside of the system? But regardless, no matter how much Bitcoin, gold, silver you own, if you don't know people that are like-minded in that area, you're done, plain and simple.
Hey guys, I want to invite each and every one of you to join me May 31st through June 2nd in Orlando for Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the annual conference I do, and this year it's going to be absolutely incredible. We're going to have some of your favorites there as speakers, guys like Jeff Snyder, Mike Green, The Real Estate, Kenny McElroy. We're going to have Robert Barnes. They're talking about freedom and liberty. Even Rich Cooper is going to be there discussing red pill issues. This event is all about giving you the intel, the insider information you need to not only survive 2024, but thrive. The whole reason I created this event was to give you the tools you need to build the future you deserve for yourself and your family. This is an event you are not going to want to miss. So to get more information, go to rebelcapitalistlive.com. You can see a full list of speakers we've had in the past. You can see clips from past events. And most importantly, you can get your tickets. As we get closer to the event, the tickets go up in price. So you're going to want to get those ASAP at rebelcapitalistlive.com. And we will see you in Orlando, May 31st through June 2nd.
And the other thing that is worth at least attempting to understand is local culture. So you mentioned that you can get money for your gold coins. Now, I grew up with a buddy of mine, and his father had a business. This was in South Africa, Johannesburg. Gold coins. So he would often purchase both gold coins from typically pawn shops who didn't really know the value of them. But they would just weigh them. He'd weigh them. And he would literally only pay...
That's what they did here. They weighed them.
He'd pay a discount to the per ounce amount. And he'd take the coins and he would melt them in his garage with a blowtorch into bars and sell them to Rand Refinery at the mint. And he would do the same thing with jewelry. So he'd take all the jewelry, he'd figure out what content of gold was in it, melt it down, put it in a bar and sell it. So the transaction really was just... where you're basically your refinery is the same kind of like your central bank. These are the guys who are going to transact bars of gold, big volume. Your retail level is your jewelry and everything else. And he was transacting that way. You could kind of transact. What we're looking at is transacting the other way, because the utility value is actually in things like jewelry. Go and look at India. How do they hold their value? They hold it around their freaking necks and on their rings. And then like, it's jewelry, right? And you can utilize jewelry easily in almost any Indian city. In fact, even in places like Dubai, you can get value for it. You could have got value if you had a bunch of gold chains around your neck and you looked like a rapper. You would have been able to eat, okay? Because that's what people understand. When you've got a community that understands that value and you show them a maple leaf, they're like, what? Where's that from? What does it look like? They don't understand the value. If they don't understand the value, it doesn't matter. Value is what people will pay for it. End of story.
Yeah, right.
You can look and you can show them on your app that this is what gold's trading at, and that, like, they don't care.
Oh, they couldn't care less.
They can understand that a bracelet or a ring or a gold, like, they can understand that. And you can, so that's the utility value in some of these things. And so, again, you come back to that societal level. Where are there societies that are almost, you know, it's like I said in Dubai, embrace the chaos. You go and you take areas and environments and countries and everything else who've been through a sufficient level of chaos that they've built workarounds to it, where they have sufficient distrust in the system that they've gone about utilizing other means of getting around and working around. And India is a good example. So in your local Indian, you know, communities, you could utilize literally jewelry as at least as a, and then you can transact in cash and use cash and whatever else is required. But the core things in terms of a plan B is A, you want to have as best as possible cash flows in some jurisdiction outside of where you are now. Try and determine where that, where you would think that might be. Put in place any of the financial infrastructure that exists, realizing it might not be useful for you. So you might put in bank accounts, and they might fall into a central bank digital currency realm, in which case you go, well, fuck that one up. But at a community level, if you've still got transactions that are taking place at a local farmer's market, at, you know, with jewelry or whatever it is, understand what their culture is, understand what they value. Because the other thing, so like you in Argentina, you found that with jewelry. I found to a certain extent in like Central America, jewelry is not even, they don't even seem to value that much at a local level.
What do they value there? Is dollars?
It's just dollars.
Yeah.
It's just dollars. Yeah.
Yeah. So the trip was actually really popular with the people commenting and on social media. So we've planned another one for Turkey, September 1st through the 15th. We're going to drive from Istanbul to Baku in Azerbaijan. And one of the main reasons I'm doing it is because Formula One is in Baku on the 15th. So instead of meeting Doug Casey, our good buddy, I'm going to take everyone to the Formula One race that goes with it. Shane's going to be there and Josh, of course. But I'm going to be really interested to see how or if it's different than Argentina, meaning that if I've got that gold coin, are they going to give me spot? Or if I've got that Bitcoin, are there going to be more people that want it? Or that silver coin. The silver coin was actually the winner here in Argentina, mm-hmm. for sure. If you could just bring enough silver coins with you, then you would be good to go. But I'm very curious to see how the cultures are different. And that might go into your plan B. So if you're someone that really wants to operate outside of the system, then maybe you would prefer Turkey to Argentina if we come to the conclusion that Turkey is a lot easier to get spot and the liquidity is easier for those forms of money that are outside the system.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. That'll be very interesting. I mean, I do know within Turkey that the way that people hold value is pretty much two things. It's gold, real estate.
And dollars.
And then all the transactions are euros and dollars. Actually, mostly euros, more euros than dollars.
All right. Well, I'm going to let, I need to think about this even more. I just wanted to get your feedback on it. And so then I can kind of take your inputs and put them into my calculation or into my formula. So hopefully I'll be able to write a report or give some conclusions to the community that are actually actionable and what people can start to do right now based on what their net worth is or their income level or what resources they have at their disposal. So thanks a lot for that, Chris, because you just like that cash flow from a plan in your plan B spot, that is just kind of a light bulb moment for me. So I'm going to be able to riff on that a lot tonight when I'm thinking this through. But let's go over into commodities. I did a video earlier today. I don't know if you saw, but they had that the Supreme Court of Switzerland, or the equivalent of the Supreme Court in Switzerland. It gave these 2,000 old ladies the right to sue the Swiss government because their claim is the Swiss government hasn't been protecting them enough from climate change, and more specifically from heat waves, which I didn't know that heat waves were a big problem right now in Switzerland. But according to these old women, I guess they are.
Never had heat waves before. That's
We've had the same temperatures, but
we've called it something else.
Yeah, I'd like to see what their definition of a heat wave is. I'm assuming in Switzerland, it's like when it gets up to 85 degrees or something like that. But regardless, it's like a big deal. And so the CNBC article was going into how you'll probably start to see this more and more and more, and what they're demanding from the government. And they now have the legal right, I guess, to demand this or else be compensated for it. is them just restricting more fossil fuels and restricting more energy use. And so where I was going with that is the supply side really shrinks. And most people just think about the price of oil from the demand side. They don't really think about it from the supply side. But even assuming that you have demand going down, not that it will, but assuming you did, then you've got, if the supply is going down even faster, the price is going up. And then you look at all of these people in Argentina or in Colombia, in Asia and Africa, they're trying to improve their standard of living. They don't give a shit about 2,000 blue hairs in Switzerland. They're just trying to use more energy.
There's two things that are really, really prevalent that people need to keep in mind. The first is that in a typical commodity cycle, you have massive overexpenditure and huge supply comes on because your pricing is there's always a delay, right? The ability to bring any commodity on stream requires intensive capital, typically debt, because it's very capital intensive industry, certainly within the fossil fuel space, but it really in the entire commodity spectrum. That means that you've got a delay between capital expenditure and ultimate supply and production. That's why you get such massive price movements within the commodity spectrum. Okay. So, and that's why you have these massive booms and busts. The last boom that we had tailed out, at least within the energy space and to some degree also in the rest of the commodity spectrum, was sort of 2012, 14. Ever since then, we've had a decimation of supply and a bear market, which is normal. We should have really come out of that roughly about 2016, and we should have ordinarily started to see capital at least stabilizing and coming back into the market in various sectors. That's never taken place. Largely, it hasn't taken place. And it hasn't taken place as a consequence largely of a couple of things. ESG, woke, bluehead people who've decided that the world's better off if we ride bicycles.
Hold on a second. Josh, fill in for me real quick.
You got to fill in for me. It's probably something from the doors.
I'll be back at 3. I got someone knocking on the door here. Driving me crazy. So okay. I'll be right.
Keep going, Chris.
we'll let George go in there. It's probably someone's offering him some cash for his Bitcoin.
Hopefully.
I found you. I'll give you $20,000 for what's Bitcoin trading at, something other than that. Anyway, you've got huge amount of supply constraints in terms of capital to be deployed into the commodity markets. The other thing that requires capital expenditure is certainty of outcome. When you're deploying large pools of capital and raising debt in order to do so, you need to have a certainty of outcome, right? Because if you look at a lot of these assets, you're looking at 20, 30 year time horizons. The long duration assets, an oil rig is a long duration asset. Okay. In order to deploy 1.2 roughly to put a rig in the ocean and a couple of OSVs, you're looking at least $2 billion. That requires debt and it requires a certainty of outcome. That certainty of outcome is basically political stability, geopolitical stability, and things of that nature. That does not exist today. Not only does it not really exist, it's increasingly going the other way because we're getting more and more geopolitical tension. And we're getting things like a bunch of blue-haired grannies who are deciding the outcomes of entire nations to some degree,
yeah,
or potentially. Yeah. In that environment, if you're an oil executive, do you really want to go and deploy that capital and take on the debt? And if you're an investor, do you want to look at that and give that oil executive money to do that? Because you're going to ask these questions. Or where are you deploying the rig? Under which jurisdiction? What are the laws? Can we actually, what about a carbon tax? Like all those sort of things. That uncertainty is amazing. It's fucking awesome for me because it's like, it just means there's an increasing lack of capital expenditure. What it does is it creates a moat around your existing businesses that are in that space. We don't need demand to go up. And by the way, it is. But even if it tapered, if your supply is cratering, And it's a depletive industry, right? It's like you're pulling stuff out of the pantry every day. At some point, it's empty and you've got to restock the pantry. We haven't been restocking. So that's one thing. Then the other is that as we move into a geopolitically frictioned environment with both civil unrest and international war, those periods historically have been inflationary. So you've got a monetary debasement that comes with that, because governments have to finance wars, and they finance wars with debt, and debt is dilutive to your purchasing power. And this is at a time when we've already got incredible levels of debt. So that entire environment is extraordinarily bullish for fossil fuels in particular, because energy always gets fought over, always. It just to me, it's like this is the more I see blue-haired grannies in Switzerland and, you know, some, I don't know, Jennifer, who now goes by the name of Jake and has got a beard, gluing himself to a bridge in, I don't know, London or whatever it is, and creating some havoc. The more I see that kind of stuff, I'm like, I'm almost championing it. I'm like, bring it on. Because the flip side of that, and this comes into those jurisdictions of which we've just been talking about to some degree, not everyone's doing this. You know, in the last COP28 thing, that was a complete disaster for these climate catastrophists, because the head of the chairman of the event, who's also the CEO of the Abu Dhabi oil company, he literally came out and said, this is nuts. When you're trying to send us back into the to living in caves, and we're not going to do that. This is ridiculous. It was a complete utter failure. A lot of the stuff that came through on CNBC and all these, they're kind of trying to mask over that. But if you went and watched, I watched a lot of the presentations given by certain individuals, and it was brutal, like brutal. I mean, it was not just we'll let you have your say. No, they were like, the hell with this. This is nonsense. And then despite that, we've seen the capital flows anyway. We've seen increased expenditure in some of these regions. China's still building tons of coal-fired power stations. India's doing the same. Saudi's doing the same. Despite them waving the going to save the planet, go green flag, the reality is that the capital they're deploying is not saying that. And that's where we're getting a big divergence. So you're getting capital constraints, which lead to a lack of expenditure in the space at a time when supply has already been decimated from the last bear market in a depletive industry, monetary inflation as a consequence of geopolitical uncertainty and wars at a time when the debts are already phenomenal. We all know that. It's hard to be bearish. Let me just say that.
So here's where I have the view is similar or the same, but maybe the time horizon is different, because what I see right now is I don't see the monetary inflation. And what we saw in 2020, 2021 was, I guess you could call that monetary inflation from the standpoint of QE resulting in M2 going up. I don't know how much that was a result of QE and then how much it was a result of line of credits being drawn down. And then I think the major component of the inflation there was the supply chain disruption. But right now you got bank credit pretty much flat. You've got loans and leases pretty much flat. So what I see is if commodities are going up and up and up, which I totally agree with. Let's just use oil as an example. It goes up to $200 a barrel. And this is a result of, let's just say we've got access to 100% right now, but because of the 2,000 grannies, now we're going to only have access to 50% that's being produced by those producers that you just mentioned. But that means the price goes way, way up for the rest of the world that, regardless of what their political views are still going to be buying that stuff the end of the day, because granny wants to turn her lights on. And so you've got, but then if you don't have a monetary inflation coming from the banking system, because they see more counterparty risk, then mm-hmm. you're robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Kind of contraction that, credit
that inelastic demand on this side, but then you've got to take money away from other spending, and therefore they go bust. Therefore the unemployment rate goes up, and therefore purchasing power goes down, which at a certain point will impact the $200 a barrel oil. Now, what I was thinking about today, Chris, is what I've seen throughout South America is a subsidy for energy. So even Petro right now in Colombia, you know, way, way left-leaning, good buddies of Chavez and Maduro and all those guys, he is still implementing the subsidy for diesel because once you get an economy hooked on that subsidy, it's tough to take it away. So you can go to a gas station in Colombia, fill up for $4 a gallon or only two a diesel. And they do this to, you know, supposedly to help the poor and middle class. So the diesel truckers, they can get goods back and forth at a cheaper rate. So what I'm thinking is, and remember back when we had high inflation in the United States, what were they doing in California? Their solution was to give stimmies, inflation stimmies. Remember that? And they were proposing the exact same thing in Canada. So do you think we could get to a point, this is kind of my hypothesis, where because of what you're talking about, oil goes up and up and up and up, but instead of getting that deflation in the price of oil like we otherwise would because of robbing Peter, pay Paul, the governments come in and subsidize and continue to subsidize the higher price, which is making it cheaper at the pump, or outright giving like inflation stimmies like we almost saw in the West, which allows the price to continue to go up and up and up and up and up. And I just threw out a number of $1,000 a barrel today over the next 10 years. You see where I'm going with that?
Yeah. I mean, it's a tricky one. I'm not, because you've got the ability to have credit, like cash, as you know, is a credit driven market. Cash is basically credit. And so the constriction in credit is a deflationary force for sure.
It's bank driven, right? So the banks are risk off. Velocity. If velocity goes down, you still got deflation.
Yeah, exactly. And then, I mean, so I think to some extent, or to a large extent, I keep coming back to a stagflationary environment. Like I give this example. If you go back and you think about the swine flu in, what was it, 97 or whatever it was? We had Asian bird flu and swine flu. I can't even remember which came first and whatever. But I remember watching those markets, not because I did anything in them, but I was just fascinated. I'm always fascinated by like the dynamics of things. And so you had, as an example, you had bird flu. And I was looking at the price of poultry and it collapsed, right? Nobody wanted to touch any poultry because they're all going to figure they were going to die. And then at the same time, in Asia, there's only really two meat sources that people have. It's pork and chicken. And so your pork went through the roof. Like you literally wanted to be long pork in a big, big way because all of the consumption of chicken collapsed, like literally collapsed. And the farmers were just chucking them on piles and burning them and killing all the chickens. And then the pork, of course, they were all transferring and like changing and becoming pork farmers. Now, in that environment, it didn't matter whether you had inflation, deflation, monetary debasement, it didn't matter what the central bank of China was doing. Didn't matter if they were taking rates up, down, sideways, whether they were QEing, or none of that mattered because the dynamics of that market were so strong that your price of your chickens was going to collapse and your price of your pork was going to go up. Okay. So I kind of keep
looking. What happens to all the other prices?
Yeah. So your other prices, those can be affected very, like if everything else is remaining roughly the same, then fine. An increase in interest rates or some other policy of that nature can certainly change those pricings. But if you have a dynamic that is very powerful, it overwhelms all of that. So, and then again, so you could have had an inflation or a deflationary environment and your price of chickens and pork were going to change. End of story. Now, that was a fairly dramatic. But when I come and I think about, say, energy in particular, we know that energy is pretty much the bedrock of society. It's the bedrock of a stable economy and a stable society. Stable societies become very unstable when you take that away and you have civil unrest. No government wants to be in a situation where they have significant civil unrest because that's when you can have revolutions. And whoever's at the top, doesn't matter whether they're good guys, bad guys, doesn't matter. people are pissed off, I can't feed the family, et cetera, et cetera, you have a problem. So they're aware of that. And hence, to some degree, probably why what they're doing in Colombia and places like that, where you do have a large poor and working class, you've got to try and keep them happy. If they get unhappy, you've got a problem.
And that's why I think you'll get the subsidy. But without the subsidy, I think the higher oil goes, that ironically, the more deflationary it is.
So you got higher, so work me through that. So you got oil going up as a consequence of subsidies.
Well, let's just back up and assume there's no subsidies, right? Like we're in the United States. And let's just say that oil goes to, or let's just use gas, because that's something everyone can relate to. Let's say it goes up to $20 a gallon. And so to your point, that's going to filter through the entire economy. But what that's going to mean is that if I'm making $1,000 a month, and right now I'm spending $100 a month on gas, then I've got $900 to spend on other stuff. But if I'm spending $500 a month on gas, now I only have $500. And therefore, that aggregate demand for everything else absolutely plummets. I mean, like Great Depression level. And therefore, the unemployment rate skyrockets. Mm. Then purchasing power goes down even more, to a point where even though demand for energy is very inelastic, it starts impacting demand and bringing the price of that oil down, because you've got a deflationary bust that's happening throughout the rest of the economy.
And then the subsidies, they'll keep subsidizing in order to try and keep that dynamic in play, to keep people happy.
That's what I think. That's what I think. If you do get that dynamic where things start
to roll over. But now let's go to the government finances. If we've now got a government, but now let's go to government finances and the ability to do that, right? Their total tax take will be collapsing because you've got a deflationary environment. Yep. Higher unemployment, less productivity, less GDP, less tax take. At the same time that there's a greater demand for them to put in subsidies for all numbers of things, including fuel. Mm-hmm. So their balance, well, the government balance sheet just flips. It just goes horrendously wrong. And then on an international basis, pricing of that debt gets repriced, and you have sovereign bankruptcies.
But maybe you do. In the United States, maybe you don't, because that's exactly what we saw play out over 2021. And, you know, not only did the dollar go up, but we've still got the 10-year trading at 100 basis points, roughly, under Fed funds, which would imply there's still massive, massive demand for United States debt. And I don't want to go way off on a tangent, but another thing that I was thinking about that I really need to solidify before I talk about it further. But if we go into CBDCs and unified ledgers, you could get into a world where the other central banks are able to create dollars, just like the euro dollar banks create them now. So they could start to issue dollar denominated debt, and they wouldn't have to worry about the FX risk. In which case, if the monetary system can only handle collateral for effectively T-bills, why couldn't Argentina start issuing those T-bills? It wouldn't be called treasuries, but it wouldn't matter, because it's a three-month government bond that's denominated in dollars. And now all of a sudden, there wouldn't be any risk, because Argentina, the central bank, can create those dollars, just like the Federal Reserve can. And if you have a monetary system that's deflating, that means that the collateral multiplier is decreasing, meaning there's less willingness to rehypothecate. And therefore, the demand for those dollar sovereign bonds continues to increase, regardless of where they're coming from. And this would potentially allow those governments to continue to subsidize the higher and higher and higher oil prices that were a result of the fundamental dynamics that you were talking about at the beginning. Now, I'm not saying that they can't. I really need to think more about the mechanics. But right now, we know that the Eurodollar banks can create as many dollars as they want. Mm. They're completely outside of the purview of the Fed. So you have to ask yourself, from a plumbing standpoint, why? How does that work? And then once you understand the plumbing, I don't know why that wouldn't also be applicable to the central banks, assuming we had CBDCs and unified ledgers that would allow them to just keep score, and where they wouldn't have to transfer assets. because that's the key. That's why they can't do it right now. Because if they transfer liabilities, they also have to transfer assets, and that's the central banks as well. But if you can get around that through a unified ledger, then it could be a game changer there. But anyway, I know I'm going way off on a tangent, but just
it's a super interesting thought experiment. I need to think through more of that. It's interesting because when you go and you look at that euro dollar system and how it functions, you're right. The central banks don't matter.
And we think that only the Fed can create dollars or you know, base money, if you want to call it that. But no, look, we've got, call it $70 trillion.
The Fed can only influence the creation of the dollar. The Fed can influence the creation or lack of creation of dollars via a certain monetary policy, but they don't, and even then you kind of, are they just following the market, you know?
Right.
I think so, to some extent that probably is. And then it's almost like, it's like a politician, you know, he waits until there's a certain trend in a certain direction. Everybody's running down the street going, I want, free healthcare. And then he goes, that's a good idea. I'll put on my jacket and call it the free healthcare jacket and just get in front of them. And everybody thinks I'm the leader of the movement.
Yeah.
When the movement was already in play. And so to some extent, I look at the Fed and I'm like, the movement's already in play. And then they kind of follow. And then people think, oh, it's the Fed. It's like, maybe not. Don't think so.
Yeah. I mean, I use the analogy of a rain dance guy, you know, in some American Indian tribe, and everyone thinks that he's the one that creates rain, but really he's just got access to see the storm clouds coming a little bit earlier than everyone else. I mean, it's the exact same thing that you're saying, but the bottom line is XYZ Euro Dollar Bank in the Cayman Islands can create dollars without having dollars. They don't
just issue credit.
That's right. They just create dollar-denominated loans that equal dollar-denominated commercial bank liabilities. So if they can do it, I don't know why, if the system was similar, why the Argentinian central bank couldn't do that to pay down dollar-denominated debt instead of having to print pesos to buy the dollars to pay down the debt.
You got me.
Well, I don't want to throw you a curveball. Let's go. We can talk about this more offline. But getting back to the kind of the dilemma there with higher oil prices, it is true that it's an input for everything. But if the money supply is not increasing, and if it's actually decreasing, that's another thing, Chris. We see M1 and M2 decreasing. I don't know if M2 is still decreasing. I'd have to look at a chart. But that's the first time that M2 has decreased in the United States since the Great Depression. You got the money supply falling off a cliff. And unless you've got velocity, if you get velocity increasing fast enough, you can definitely still have consumer price inflation with the money supply falling.
Yeah.
But if you've got velocity falling and money supply falling at a certain point, that the rubber's got to meet the road.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying, and you know that I'm extremely bullish on commodities, because I think that what will happen at the end of the day is if we do have a deflationary force, which I think is the underlying current of the economy at large, the central banks or the really not really monetary, but fiscal is going to come in and do what they did in 2020.
We've always,
at the very least, anti-deflationary.
Yeah. No, you're bang on right. I mean, it's every scenario that you have, especially if you're invested into it, you should dedicate a certain amount of time to challenging that opinion. Like when you're right, you just make money. When I'm right, we just make money. It's that's not the threat. The threat is when you're wrong and you don't identify it early enough and get in there fast enough to address it. That's when problems come about. So it's always a useful exercise to throw rocks at everything that you do. And I realize also, it's an unpopular way of going about doing things, but it's absolutely the best way to go about doing it.
I think that's what creates the roller coaster ride. Like I'd be willing to bet a lot of money that let's just say, even in real terms, we fast forward 10 years and oil's at $500 a barrel, that in real terms. But I think obviously it's not going to go there in a straight line. And I think that's what creates that roller coaster ride, is the deflationary pressures of the economy going through this, because it wants to deleverage. it wants to deleverage. Yeah. There's just too much effing debt.
Yeah.
But then you've got the cross current of the governments trying to prevent that, which is inflationary. Even if they're not creating more money supply, they're creating economic distortions.
Yeah.
Which creates fewer goods and services, yeah,
because, they can just put in some new policy which restricts supply, and any restriction of supply is dynamically inflationary. So first order thinking of what can happen with those underlying drivers in the economy, and then it's also second order thinking of what happens when X happens. You know, so if you go and you have a look at read a ton of history, you can have these sorts of dynamics in play. But what it then also does in terms of societies, politics, like you can have the rise of political parties that never even bloody existed before in these times,
right,
largely as a consequence of the dynamics in play. For example, Milei, right, where you are, Javier Milei was a nothing 10 years ago. No one knew about him. He was just this crazy rock star, he did rock, and that was one of his side things, rock star, and I think he might have, yeah, anyway. And then he slowly started gaining traction, and here we are today with him in power in the country, which nobody could have really seen 5 years ago. I remember, we first invested in Argentina in October 21, and at the time, no one was really betting that he was going to come in, and we weren't investing it based on him coming in either. There was a whole that set of other factors, which we'll go into another time. But the point is, the extremes that have been experienced within Argentina were the fertile roots for him to come to power. Now, whether he stays in power, anyone's guess. But there's a whole lot of dynamics that happen when you have these extreme situations like we're experiencing to some degree, and I expect will experience. There's many other things that take place as a consequence that you just, it's hard to identify what those are going to be. I think certainly one of them is just going to be, to a large extent, chaos. And then another factor is where you've got something happening in a particular economy, it also affects other economies. So like the United States is a big deal. What happens there naturally affects other economies. Whatever happens there, if it's deflationary, for example, how does that affect credit creation outside of the US? How does it affect bond prices in other jurisdictions where most debts in the world are still dollar-denominated debts? So you could have, let's say, Southeast Asia. What if we've got a deflationary environment domestically in the US? What does that mean for Southeast Asia, where increasingly their trade is with China? What does that mean there? Well, we can run through some of the scenarios. Firstly, debt becomes cheaper.
Yeah, but cash flows become scarcer.
Well,
because so just looking at it globally, because if you have globally of deflation, right? So the economy is slowing down, velocity is slowing down, so your cash flow becomes less and less in aggregate total.
Mm-hmm.
But it does decrease the cost of your debt. So you've got to.
There's a variable thing. Yeah.
Yeah,
but then it can also come into domestic debt, because if you've got the deflation that's taking place, for example, in the US is largely as a consequence of massive debt. It's trying to deflate. Mm-hmm. And you can take in an economy that doesn't have the same level of domestic debt. They don't have the same pressure. Like if you're thinking about gauges, pressure gauges, one's got a big pressure gauge, it's got to come down. Another one's got a much smaller pressure gauge, doesn't have as much to come down, but they're still dynamically experiencing the similar dynamics because everything's dollar denominated, right? So now they'll have deflation, but much, much less. And if their trading partners are experiencing similar situations, you can actually have a totally different dynamic. I know, what's his name? Louis Garvey was talking about this with respect to we've sort of talked about deglobalization, and certainly there's deglobalization to some extent, but largely it's a Western phenomenon. If you look at all the trade deals that are being done just over the last 10 years and on increasingly being done anywhere from Istanbul across to Jakarta, and you've got about 4 billion people in that space there.
Right.
They are globalizing. They're globalizing. They're doing more trade together. They're opening trade more. They're restricting barriers to entry. Like, it's literally globalization across this whole spectrum of the world. And right. and most Westerners are going, no, it's deglobalization. Yes, it's deglobalization largely in the Western-dominated societies. Like, now Europe, you, as an American, you now have to get a visa to go into Europe, for example. That's a restriction. That's a friction. That's a constraint. That's an anti-globalization to some degree, right? So the point I guess I'm making is it's there's a lot to cover.
Yeah. It's a bifurcated, becoming more bifurcated, the world, and you've got a component of it that's doing the opposite, or you've got one side that's doing the opposite of the other side. But what's fascinating is what connects them both is the banking system, because it's the exact same banking system that the 4 billion people are dependent on in that Asian area that you talked about. And it's the exact same banking system that the West is dependent on. It's all one banking system, the euro dollar system. And so how does the euro dollar system respond as far as liquidity for the one side that is globalizing while the other side is deglobalizing? And does that prevent the globalizing economies from running on all eight cylinders?
Well,
it's very,
yeah. I think you go back to sufficient history. You've got like about a 250-year cycle, which is a revolutionary war cycle. It actually ties back into like the French Revolution. What you typically will often have is it's almost like the Pareto distribution, right? Generally, there'll be some dominant society, some dominant company that roughly controls 80% of everything. And then the rest of the 20% is controlled by the rest. And even sectors. There'll be one sector that's roughly 80% and it's the dominant sector for a period of time, et cetera, et cetera. In the world, that dominant power has been the United States ever since World War II. Okay. When you go through massive transitions, everything gets shaken up. And finally, you will come out with another dominant society that will control 80%. But that period of time can last sometimes up to like 100 years to get there. Right. Okay. That period in between is massively chaotic. I was doing a whole lot of research about like the Hanseatic League, which was through a period of time where it was, the world was in chaos, but that league was basically a trade organization with traders who were, they aligned with and basically were the, almost the fuel behind city-states. And the city-states became very, very wealthy. So you didn't have this dominant big society or country or anything that was actually powerful and controlled the world. It was this chaotic period. But within it, the Hanseatic League became one of the most powerful dominant organizations, if you will.
Right.
And so I feel like we might be going or might head into something like that where there isn't one dominant for a while, but it is a chaotic experience and it is a very chaotic time.
Yeah, because my point is both of them are dependent on the same banking system. And let's just assume for a moment that I'm the banking system in Singapore that's catering toward that group of people that are growing economically and producing more and more and more and doing business with one another. And you are the banking system that's focusing on the West that is having problems, that's slowing down. The standard of living is decreasing. You have all these deflationary pressures that are being, that are rearing their ugly head from time to time and then being solved, quote unquote, by the governments coming in and doing more fiscal or whatever it is that just destroys the economy even more. But we are dependent upon one another. In order for me to be at full capacity lending for the productivity of my area, I have to do business with you. And if you are risk off, then that's going to impact me and my ability to provide liquidity for all the other businesses that are in my jurisdiction. So I guess to your point, we will need to see or likely see a bifurcation, not only with the economies, but with the banking systems themselves, which since 1950 have basically been under one roof. So it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out.
No, I mean, that's the biggest threat with all of this stuff, because that is, that's the glue that's holding everything together. But we've already begun to see that the fractions in that, right? With the Russians, who've set up basically a different system. We're seeing at a corporate level, like I said, in Russia, utilization of things like USDT. Now, it's still utilizing the existing banking infrastructure, but it's taking chunks of it and it's saying we're eliminating that and we're using this. That's the beginnings of utilization of a new system by sheer force, because you have to, right? If you're so as you have all these pressures, the cool thing with us humans is we're super flexible. We're smart and we're flexible, and we will develop technologies and tools and resources to address any problem that's put in front of us, which is already beginning to take place. But again, it's a chaotic period of time, and that banking system is the biggest. It's the behemoth which is controlling everything, and changing that is both high friction, eliminating it and bringing in something new, I think is going to take place, because it's old. It's inefficient. I mean, it just is in an inefficient, costly infrastructure. So it'll probably be replaced, but. You know, that replacement of it is not going to be a smooth sailing path of, hey, it's not the iPhone 13 to the iPhone 14. It's just, yeah. It's not even the BlackBerry to the iPhone. It's a whole different experience.
Yeah, I don't know that it'll be replaced, because it has evolved through free market forces. For the most part, obviously, there's been government interference and whatnot. But for the most part, it's free market forces have got us to where we are today. And so I don't know that the free market would create an infrastructure or a network that's too dissimilar to what we have right now. But it would be different people or different entities actually controlling and doing business with one another, even from the standpoint of the banking system. Even if that network between banks looked very similar to what we have today, because why reinvent the wheel, you know? So anyway, Chris, I've kept you for an hour and a half, buddy.
Cool. Love it.
Say that we're going to talk for about 45 minutes and then we just continue to talk. It's been fantastic. You're going to be at Rebel Capitalist Live. I can't wait to see you there. So if you guys haven't got your tickets, you definitely have to do that ASAP.
And come and see us.
Yeah. Come and hang out with Chris live, have a couple beers, and you can just ask him any of your questions and pick his brain and understand what's happening with commodities on the supply side, the demand side, and everything in between. You want to shout out your website or your Twitter handle or anything?
Websites, capitalistexploits.at. And Twitter handles, shit, what is it?
It's the same thing.
Capitalist EXP.
There you go.
I don't even remember it.
All right, buddy. Thanks for coming on, and we'll talk soon.
Okay. All the best. Take care.